Tchaikovsky set off on a high-profile musical tour of Europe that included stops in Berlin, Leipzig, and Hamburg. In Leipzig, he arrived for lunch at the home of a friend, and who was there rehearsing a recent piano trio but Johannes Brahms? We're told by David Brown it was the first encounter of what was to prove an uneasy, ambivalent relationship. At a Gewandhaus concert, Tchaikovsky heard Brahms direct his new double concerto, but found the piece left him quite unmoved. In all their encounters of his six-day stay, Tchaikovsky admitted Brahms did everything he could to be agreeable, but Tchaikovsky found him an easier drinking companion than a conversationalist, more comfortable in retrospect than as a presence. As with a man, so with a musician, winning deep respect but not affection. Tchaikovsky still could find nothing to persuade him to like Brahms' music any better, or to believe that the German composer merited the reputation he enjoyed in Russia, as well as with certain expats from his land. That from David Brown in his study, Tchaikovsky, The Final Years. Tchaikovsky returned home and shortly after his travels began to work on and complete is Symphony No. 5. After Tchaikovsky conducted the work in St. Petersburg and Prague, though, he had significant doubts. Doubts arose, and perhaps we might say he was suffering from the Brahms syndrome. Brahms was very much a self-critic and actually destroyed many of his pieces that he felt didn't measure up. As we learn from Jonathan Kramer, Tchaikovsky wrote to his patroness, "I have become convinced that this symphony is unsuccessful." It's clear, though, that the respect between Tchaikovsky and Brahms was mutual, and we'll soon hear that Brahms made it a priority to hear this symphony, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. We're invited to hear Tchaikovsky's Fifth, led by a conductor who has enormous respect and affection for both Brahms and Tchaikovsky, Rick Hoffenberg, music director of the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra. This weekend, they will present two concerts with Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5 and Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 2, featuring as soloist Christiana Oppenheimer-Vida. At Wyoming Seminary in Kingston and Marywood University in Scranton, where Dr. Hoffenberg is co-chair of the Department of Music, Theater, and Dance. Rick Hoffenberg stopped in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about the program.
I thought it was time that the orchestra do one of Tchaikovsky's symphonies. I believe I'm in my sixth year as music director, and we had not yet done that. And the fourth, fifth, and sixth symphonies of Tchaikovsky are masterpieces by anyone's standard. And I wanted especially the young people in the orchestra who are playing in the ensemble as part of their education to have the experience of doing one of these great pieces. So the Fifth Symphony is one of my favorites. In some ways, I think it bridges the gap between the fourth and the sixth. I mean, the fourth was really a launching pad for a new scale of symphony for Tchaikovsky, a new grandeur of expression, new length, new uses of instrumentation, and it was very programmatic, as was the Manfred Symphony, which he wrote between the fourth and the fifth. It's not one of the numbered symphonies, but he really wrote seven in total. But then when you get to the fifth, I think he started having second thoughts about approaching things in a programmatic way. He started having misgivings about revealing everything about the extra musical inspiration that he had initially done with the fourth and with the Manfred. And by the time we get to the sixth, it's a big mystery that people are still trying to figure out, that incredible Pathetique symphony, the last that he wrote. But we really don't know much about its inspiration. The fifth, we have some clues, but I think he was going through a transition of philosophy, which I might say he wasn't the only composer. Mahler, similarly, when the Mahler First Symphony premiered shortly after the Tchaikovsky Fifth, there was a programmatic description of it, which Mahler later rescinded. And I guess they may have felt that the music needed to stand on its own, and if people were too reliant on a story, perhaps they didn't appreciate the music on its own merits. But in any case, the fifth, you can appreciate it from any standpoint. You can try to figure out what Tchaikovsky meant in his use of this incredible motive that's known as the fate motive that occurs throughout the symphony in different ways, different dynamics, different keys, different instrumentations. How he uses it is brilliant. You can try to figure out what he meant by that, or you can just appreciate this as a marvel of instrumentation and expressiveness and beautiful themes. It's quite a remarkable piece.
And when you're conducting a piece of such magnitude, talk to us about the challenges of sustaining something that's going to be lasting a little while.
You know, it's funny, I talk about this with my conducting classes toward the end. One of our last classes, I always talk with them about large-scale structure, because I think it's one of the hardest things to wrestle with as a conductor. I mean, the first movement of this Tchaikovsky symphony is very large. And if you look at the form, it's very tightly constructed. It all makes sense, but it's on such a large scale. And somehow you want the audience members to come away with a conception of how the pieces fit together. And I think part of it is subconscious. I can share with the orchestra an analysis of the piece, but I'm not sure that actually is the right means to the end. I think if I go in with a clear idea of how everything fits together, that will impact the way I conduct it. That will impact my interpretation in terms of choices of tempo, of dynamic, of colors. And I really think that's the best way to try to get across at least one person's interpretation, my interpretation, not necessarily the best or the only one, but one interpretation of how the pieces of this movement fit together. You know, the more I come back to this movement, the less massive it seems, the tighter it seems. It just all makes perfect sense, and it starts to seem like what comes after any individual moment in the movement is inevitable. And you start to think it couldn't progress any other way, which makes it all the more amazing that Tchaikovsky had such difficulty composing this symphony. I mean, he had tremendous doubts about whether he was all composed out, if he really had inspiration left in him. And of course, the answer speaks for itself, not only in this symphony, but just weeks after he finished it, he started working on Sleeping Beauty. And then, of course, this incredible sixth symphony that was yet to come. So he certainly wasn't composed out at all.
What about the clarinets? What about the horns, the trumpet?
Yeah. It's amazing. You know, all of the instrumental groups get such special moments. I mean, the beloved horn solo in the second movement, which was turned into a pop tune in 1939. And even if Tin Pan Alley hadn't had their hand in it, people can't help but be swept up in the beauty, the love of that theme, the warmth that's conveyed by it, and the way he introduces the clarinet to weave so seductively around that beautiful horn theme, and then he brings in the oboe, and you can tell he knows so intimately and accurately the timbre of each instrument and the way he uses them. And of course, there are themes that are so intimately associated with the instruments that play them. There are motives for the horns as a unit. There are trumpet motives, and the trombones have wonderful moments. It's a symphony that I think brings great gratification to everyone in the orchestra.
And you're finding that in rehearsal, that you're eating it up?
Well, you know, I think from the very beginning, the people in the orchestra, I'm sure some of them were familiar with the piece, and even the ones who weren't, I think it's very immediately gratifying in that you can sort of tell what Tchaikovsky was getting at. You know, when we first read the piece, we were still getting to know it, and, you know, of course, there was a lot of work to be done. But even through that, despite mistakes in figuring things out, I think members of the orchestra could tell what it will ultimately sound like. We as a group, I think, had a collective vision for how this piece should sound. And that's not always the case. Even with great pieces of music, sometimes a great piece of music will take a lot of digging. And after many rehearsals, you sort of uncover this gem. You didn't realize just how fantastic it was when you started working on it. And that has its own wonders, and we've done pieces like that, and I love that, the process of discovery through it. In the case of the Tchaikovsky, I think from the very beginning, we had a sense of the trajectory that we would take with this piece, despite the fact that there are great difficulties for the orchestra and tremendous challenges. I think we knew what we wanted it to sound like.
When we first hear this motif you've talked about, what is the mood when we're just getting introduced to it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting contrast with the way Tchaikovsky introduces the Fourth Symphony. The Fourth Symphony is launched with a theme that we also know as a fate motive, and it's in a blaze of horns, the symphony is announced. And the opening of the Fifth Symphony is much darker. You hear the strings and clarinet in a rather slow, somber, subtle way introduce the theme that will intersperse itself throughout all four movements, throughout the entire piece in various ways as a kind of motto. And this is a brilliant idea that I think traces its lineage at least back to Berlioz. If you look at the Symphonie Fantastique with the Idée Fixe, you see this use of a theme all the way through, almost like an opera's leitmotif. And in Tchaikovsky's hands, what's so amazing is the way he adapts it to the mood of the moment. It is very operatic in a sense. We have to remember Tchaikovsky was a successful opera composer. In the 10 years between the Fourth and Fifth Symphonies, he composed, I believe, four operas, including Eugene Onegin, which is considered one of the great Russian operas ever composed. He also wrote Pique Dame, Queen of Spades, very successful opera. And so I think he treats that motive almost operatically. You get a sense of the drama that's going to unfold from the very beginning because it is quite somber and there are silences in between. And it's not this triumphant beginning of a symphony that we might expect if we're familiar with the Fourth.
You mentioned Sleeping Beauty, and we know the waltzes Tchaikovsky composes. What is this waltz like?
We might expect that there's a scherzo as the third movement of the symphony, and instead we get this lilting waltz that sounds rather simple at the outset and becomes very intricate and virtuosic in the middle. And when you finally come back to the waltz theme toward the end of that movement, you feel like you have taken such a journey. Each of the four movements in the piece despite being connected thematically and being linked in a way that makes perfect programmatic sense, each one is so distinct and such a unique sound world. And I think the third movement, this major key waltz, with the lightness that it brings, is a much needed respite from the darkness that we get in the outside movements.
You want to say anything about the finale?
Sure. You know, I adore the finale. One of the things that struck me, my first impression when I got to know this symphony was it almost seemed like Tchaikovsky didn't know how to end the piece, because there are a few different moments where he could have ended it, and you know, he gets suddenly faster here and you think, okay, this is the final windup, this is the final coda, and then he slows it down and gets grand again, and it's remarkable the way he incorporates, goes from minor to major and utilizes different tempos and different meters. It's quite a complex approach to an ending. It's interesting, when Brahms first encountered this piece, Brahms delayed a trip in order to hear this new symphony, and he was very impressed with the first, second, and third movements. Didn't like the finale so much, which is particularly ironic, because I will add, and I don't think anybody's a bigger Brahms fan than I am. I absolutely worship Brahms. But he certainly had his own troubles with finales. We have quite a number of wonderful Brahms large-scale pieces that have great movements, except the finale, you know, doesn't quite measure up. So I don't know if he was projecting his own concerns about his writing onto Tchaikovsky's, but he had misgivings about this finale. I think now, having gotten to know the piece, I think it's the only way the symphony could have ended. I think it's the perfect culmination of this motto theme, and it builds with moments of such tender expressiveness, and ultimately builds to such a arousing climax in such an unexpected way. And I think that's what makes it so effective. This piece is never fits any sort of cookie cutter path, and that continues to the very last measures.
If we know anything about court orchestras, we know that someone like Haydn knows the talents of his players, and he can write for them and present the results. An orchestra like yours can have some wonderful players all the way through the orchestra, a particular cellist perhaps, and you could program a concerto for that soloist.
For sure, and I'm a great admirer of Christiana Oppenheimer-Vida, well known to musicians in this area. Just a spectacular musician and cellist, and one of the real driving musical forces in civic orchestra. We couldn't do what we do without her. And one of the things she does that's so wonderful is she always, because of her pedagogical skills, she always cultivates a terrific cello section. So even taking her out of the cello section in order to play the solo part, I have to acknowledge that she prepares the rest of that cello section so beautifully that I'm not worried at all. But she's a real linchpin of the orchestra, and this piece is a wonderful demonstration of all her abilities. It's a terribly difficult piece, and we considered a number of pieces for her to do as concerto soloist, and this one, I think, it's a wonderful pairing with the Tchaikovsky in many ways. It's quite sprightly and optimistic, and I think a good foil for some of the darkness in the Tchaikovsky, but also quite a spectacular vehicle for her virtuosity and her musicianship. It has an interesting history. I don't think musicians knew for sure that it was even composed by Haydn until 1951 in a library in Austria. An autographed score in Haydn's hand with his signature was discovered. But prior to that, many people thought that it was written by a cellist named Antonin Kraft, who played in the Esterházy Orchestra that Haydn wrote the piece for. And undoubtedly, Kraft had input on the solo part. There's no question that Haydn would have consulted with him on the writing of the solo part. But we can now be, because of that autograph, we can now be confident that the composer is Haydn. And you hear so many charms of Haydn's hand that are reminiscent of other better-known pieces. Haydn wrote two cello concertos. Many listeners will know the first cello concerto in C, which is a piece I like very much. I have to say I'm partial to the second. I think it's even, it's in many ways, I think, developed even beyond the C major concerto, more difficult, more ambitious for the orchestra, with a large, well-developed first movement and beautiful writing.
It's not the kind of concerto that we sometimes find where it's all about the cello and you all are just marking time to provide a backdrop for it.
No, that's true. As a matter of fact, I think in many ways it's a conversation between the cello and the orchestra, which really is what a concerto should be. So I think in its truest sense, Haydn lived up to that way of writing the piece.
Now you have to tell us where and how we can hear these pieces.
My pleasure. So we're going to perform the concert twice. It will be this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Saturday, January 26th. And that performance is at Wyoming Seminary at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts in Kingston. Not to be confused with the Wilkes-Barre Kirby Center. The still relatively new venue at the Upper School of Wyoming Seminary, the Kirby Center for Creative Arts. And then on Sunday, January 27th, it will be in the Setlev Ergeta Center at Marywood University in Scranton. And both performances are at 8 p.m. Both performances are free. No tickets are required. So I will ask your audience members to please come and bring 20 of their closest or most distant friends. I think it's a really audience-friendly program, just a charming, impressive concerto and one of the great symphonies of the 19th century repertoire.
Dr. Rick Offenberg, music director of the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, speaking with us about this weekend's concerts featuring Symphony No. 5 in E minor, Opus 64, by Tchaikovsky, with this exquisite horn solo among other highlights. On the program as well, Cello Concerto No. 2 in D major by Joseph Haydn, featuring cellist Christiana Oppenheimer-Weida. And the performances will be on Saturday, January 26th at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts at Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, just across the river from Wilkes-Barre, and Sunday, January 27th at the Setlev Ergeta Center at Marywood University in Scranton. The concerts begin at 8 o'clock each night. For more information on the web, wyomingseminary.org, wyomingseminary.org. Admission is free. The Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, under the direction of Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, Saturday at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts at Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, and Sunday, January 27th at the Setlev Ergeta Center, and that's at Marywood University in Scranton. Each concert getting underway at 8 o'clock. Admission is free. Again, more information on the web, wyomingseminary.org.